Boy, this Stephen Hawking quote has really stirred up some stuff. Was that pretty accurate in the things that he has said, that the universe wasn't created by a god?
Well, actually, it wasn't. What we said was that God isn't necessary to explain the creation of the universe. We say that the laws of nature can explain it, and we describe how that is. And we also explain how the laws, how science can explain why the laws of nature are what they are without reference to a god, because that's another question that people have wondered about, because they're very finely tuned so it's to allow our existence. But on another level, there's just, it seems that our environment is very habitable, and people have always wondered why that is and whether we need a god to explain that. So we give the scientific or a scientific explanation for all that, and the quote that you played is accurate, of course, even talking about it, that we've shown that God isn't necessary, but we did not say that God didn't create the universe, and we don't try to actually banish God. We really stick narrowly to our science and what the implications are of the scientific arguments.
Yeah, I mean,
some of the media stir about this is a bit, due to a misunderstanding, I think.
Yeah, well, I saw that 2 weeks ago, and I'm looking at it going, boy, if he said this is pretty dramatic. And it was, it ran all across the planet. Every outlet had it. So, on one end, it's great publicity for the book, The Grand Design. On the other, it makes people say, come on now, what did Stephen Hawking really mean? So we'll get into that and your views too, Leonard, as well. How well do you know Stephen? I know you've done some works with him before. I mean, are you like bosom buddies? How well do you know him?
Well, we've worked together for quite a long time. I think we started in 2002, and it's been pretty intense. I've spent a lot of time with him. When we're together, we usually have dinner every night and lunch together and talk about the world and personal life and all sorts of things. So I know him pretty well.
Good.
And it's been fun writing the books.
How is his attitude? I mean, he's been confined to his wheelchair for, gosh, years. And he's got this remarkable ability, something I never could have. How is his temperament now and his just mood?
Well, it's actually pretty amazing. I mean, one of the things that first affected me when I started working with him was his attitude. It's very inspirational because it's so hard for him to communicate and to get out his thoughts. And of course, he's thinking, five times faster than anybody else and has a lot to say. And he speaks five times slower than anybody else. And just to overcome that and to deal with not being able to move and everything else that he has to deal with puts your problems when you work with him in perspective. And you realize that, with the right determination and really with the right kind of sense of humor and optimism, you can overcome these things. And he really does have a great sense of humor and a great optimism. And he's very stubborn. He's a stubborn man. And that's very good, I think, both in physics and when you have a disability, to help you overcome that. And he says it's his greatest and his worst trait, depending on who it's being turned against, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
But, as a theoretical physicist, if you're not stubborn, you're never going to really solve anything, because theoretical physics is difficult, and you just have to persevere and just keep going.
How would he react, Leonard, if I asked him point blank, do you believe Stephen Hawking in God?
How he'd react, because we've had those discussions.
Okay.
And we decided we didn't want to talk about that in public, about our personal beliefs, because we wanted the arguments in the book, the scientific-based arguments, to stand on their own. And it's not a book on theology, and we're not telling people what to believe, and we don't want to, get involved with what we believe. We just want to talk about what science says.
Throughout this night, I'll be asking you some questions about the grand design, just to get your take on how you think things started, where things are going, and I may interject a little divine intervention every once in a while to get your take on that. But tell me about the book, The Grand Design. How long was it conceived, and the theme of it?
Well, we got the idea after we had written A Briefer History of Time, and A Briefer History of Time we wrote together, which was a clearer version of A Brief History of Time, Stephen's very famous book that he wrote in the 80s. And it was updated, and that went very well. And then after we did that, I thought it would be good to to write a book on his latest ideas, because that had been a couple decades of his said past since the work that that book was based on. And I know his thinking had moved forward, and he had come to some really interesting new ideas around 2005, and the WMAP satellite was giving us great new data about observational data about the microwave background radiation. And I thought it would be great to write another book on his latest thinking. So he comes to Caltech every year for about 4 to 6 weeks. And one time when he came and visited, I just popped into his office and I said, "Hey, Stephen, how about if we write a new book on your latest thinking?" And he just thought for about a second. He said, "Sure."
That's great.
And that was that. You know, that it took 4 years to write the book. So, but the book is about two central questions. One is, where did the universe come from? And the other one is, why are the laws of nature what they are? So we're applying his latest theories and the latest thinking in physics to answer those questions.
And when you write the book with him, does he dictate to you into a tape recorder? Do you just take notes? Or does he talk into a computer that writes for him? How does he do this?
No, not at all. We went back and forth. I would write parts off on my own. He would write parts. We trade them. We discuss them. We revise them, so on, back and forth, until we've each gone over each other's work.
Yeah.
And started to separate. But we would kind of divide up the work and talk about what would be in it, and then one or the other of us would write it. And for me, it was a little bit like being his graduate student, because the about, well, it's actually fun being a graduate student. If anyone out there has been one. And at my age, it was good to go back and do that again. So.
Well, especially with a teacher like Hawking, you know, that makes it even better.
So his job was to teach me his latest thinking, and of course, I knew what the thinking in physics was, and we put that together and synthesized and figured out the implications, and then figured out, you know, how to explain it for the general public. So we worked both together when he was here at Caltech every year, and I would go out to Cambridge a few times a year for an extended period. And when we were together, I would sit at his side, and we would go over pages and talk about what was written, what we need to write next, and in between we would each do our part, and we'd email it back and forth. I don't know if your listeners know how he communicates. If you want, I can.
Yeah, let's go through that. You know, we've seen pictures of it, and we obviously have heard him, but take us through those steps that he goes through.
Well, you know, he was diagnosed, I think he was 22 at the time, and now he's 68, so he was given a couple of years to live, and they're off by at least an order of magnitude.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So he's older than I am by a good amount, but I, you know, I always think that he'll outlive me. He's just like the ever-ready bunny. And some years ago, when I first met him, he was giving a talk at Princeton when I first saw him, and he could still talk. He was in his wheelchair then. It was in the 70s, but he needed a graduate student who was used to listening to him to translate. So he would talk, and the graduate student would make it out and then repeat it. But more recently, he's had to use electronic systems to help, because for a long time now, he can't talk. And he at first would use his thumb to click a mouse, and that would be his only way of getting output. And now he has a motion sensor on his glasses to detect when he twitches his right cheek.
Amazing.
And from that to talking is a long way, but what he has is that signal is sent to the computer on his wheelchair, and there's a screen in front of him. And essentially, he picks out a letter, and then the computer offers him some words. And he can either choose one of those words, or he can choose the second letter. And then, of course, it offers some words with those first two letters, and so on, until he either spells out a word or picks a word. And then he goes on to the next word. And it's kind of a laborious process. And, you know, just like when you play a computer game, you sometimes miss and have to go back. And that's how it goes, and he has extraordinary patience with it, and it's taught me patience just watching him do it.